This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today in the show, the future, by which I mean the present, which was the future not so long ago. I think you know this image. It's iconic. The moon is a big white face smiling in a black sky. It's really an actor in makeup with craters on his face. Suddenly, a bullet-sized rocket lands smack into his left eye, making him wince. It's one of the earliest films, Le Voyage dans la Lune, or A Trip to the Moon, based on a Jules Verne story. But this is just funny old stuff. It's got nothing to do with actual space travel, right? Or maybe it does. Claire Evans is the editor who relaunched the science magazine Omni, and she thinks Jules Verne was onto something.
He just extrapolated from the technology around him. So in From the Earth to the Moon, people go to space in a giant cannon, a massive sort of shotgun barrel shoots people into space. That's not what happened in the real world, but that essential gesture is correct.
That gesture, blasting tubes full of people into space, it's not really so different to imagine a giant cannon as it is to imagine the Saturn rockets that carried Apollo astronauts.
A successful science fiction story or novel or film allows its readers to become comfortable with the future, with radical new technologies and ideas before they become commonplace. It softens the edge of change.
Real-life science and technology are full of ideas cribbed from and inspired by the imaginations of fiction writers, artists, and filmmakers. Like, did you know that H.G. Wells, the time machine guy, imagined the first atomic bomb?
The gaunt face hardened to grimness, and with both hands, the bomb thrower lifted the big atomic bomb from the box and steadied it against the side. It was a black sphere, 2 feet in diameter. Very quickly, he bent forward, bit the stud, and hoisted the bomb over the side. The bomb flashed blinding scarlet in midair and fell, a descending column of blaze, eddying spirally in the midst of a whirlwind. When he could look down again, it was like looking down upon the crater of a small volcano.
More like a radioactive hand grenade, but this was 1913 in a story called The World Set Free, 30 years before the Manhattan Project. And another amazing example, the first geostationary satellite was described in a British technical paper from 1945. The author was Arthur C. Clarke, the science fiction writer. Clarke had a degree in mathematics, and in fact, the orbit of communications and weather satellites today is called the Clarke orbit in his honor. But Clarke is better known for his fiction, especially his collaboration with Stanley Kubrick on 2001 A Space Odyssey, still one of the best movies about life in space.
Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
There is an Arthur C. Clarke Center for Human Imagination at UC San Diego. David Brin is the astrophysicist and novelist who helped create it.
There was a period during the space race when suddenly science fiction authors were very much in vogue, when they were on the platforms next to Walter Cronkite and talking about the future of civilization and where we were going to go next.
You followed space longer than almost anybody, except maybe the first rocketeers.
Here is Arthur Clarke with Walter Cronkite on TV in 1969.
What do you think the significance of Apollo 10 is?
Well, you know, it's as if we're at Kitty Hawk now in 1900 and, say, about November 1903, and the Wrights are just playing around with their airplane, and we're trying to anticipate what importance this is going to be and accept that this is more important, probably, than the conquest of the air. So it depends on the time scale you take. In the long run, the conquest of space is going to be much more important than the conquest of the air, because after all, the airplane only took us to places we'd already been to. But what's happening now, we're going to go to new worlds.
But as society became more skeptical, so did science fiction. In the 1980s, the hot genre was cyberpunk, which imagined, before the web existed, seductive digital fantasy worlds and virtual relationships.
Cyberpunk was the first science fiction movement to really understand that science and technology weren't separate from us. Those stories and novels are about technology that is with us, that is under our skins, that is in our minds.
Clara Evans loved the stuff as a teenager, and so did the generation that created the internet as we know it.
A year here and he still dreamed of cyberspace, hope fading nightly, all the speed he took.
Here's William Gibson reading from his 1984 novel Neuromancer. When he coined the term cyberspace, he imagined it as being totally addictive, so much more interesting than real life, almost painful to disconnect from. Sound familiar?
But the dreams came on in the Japanese night like live wire voodoo, and he'd cry for it, cry in his sleep and wake alone in the dark, curled in his capsule in some coffin hotel, his hands clawed into the bed slab, temper foam bunched between his fingers, trying to reach the console that wasn't there.
A good science fiction story, to quote the writer Frederick Pohl, should be able to predict not the automobile, but the traffic jam.
What is technology doing to us as a culture? How is it changing our children? You know, when you see a two-year-old reach for an iPad and intuitively understand the interface, what does that mean about the future generation? Science fiction looks at that two-year-old with an iPad and says, okay, what is that kid, when that kid is 50 years old, what does the world look like? What has changed?
And it doesn't have to look scary. David Brin says we have to keep writing and reading science fiction about the distant future with better possibilities, because it's pretty hard to get people to build something that nobody has ever imagined.
There are opportunities out there. And if we're a bold civilization, if we regain some of the boldness of the 60s, while chastened by some of the warnings that came after that, then we'll be able to reach out for the things our grandchildren need. Asteroidal resources, for example, that could make us so rich that we could turn the Earth into a park. That sounds utopian. And yet so were so many of the things we take for granted about our own civilization.
David Brin is the author of the Uplift trilogy and other books. Clara Evans is the editor of Omni. And I'm Kurt Anderson. In Studio 360 today, we're looking at artists of all kinds who imagined the future in which we're living right now.